The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
Shantideva taught, what is protecting the body? It's the avoidance of what is harmful. And by what means is all this accomplished? By giving up fruitless activities. This is achieved through constant mindfulness. Mindfulness arises from deep appreciation. And as for disappreciation, when you understand the virtue of peace, enthusiasm will come. This is from a text, not the one that we're studying. It's called the Compendium of Training. It's a fairly dense compendium of training, sort of a ongoing presentation that just moves through all different aspects of Dharma practice. And I think there's only one translation in English I came upon, and it's old. It's an older translation, so it has kind of a biblical tone to it. Some of those early translations had that. But I thought early in Sesshin, it's good to sort of consider the basics. And so how do we avoid what is harmful? How do we give up fruitless activities, achieve constant mindfulness, and develop appreciation? That when we understand the quality of peace, the reality of peace, when we begin to taste that, enthusiasm arises. The Indian master Sangha, who helped to develop the Yogacara school, said that there are four basic elements to practice. The first is faith. And in this teachings of Shantideva, in these elements of practice by a Sangha, you know, what it makes clear is that I remember many, many years ago, we were in Sesshin. Myotai Sensei was giving a talk, and the people who came to empty the dumpster came to empty the dumpster. Easy enough, except that their truck broke down. And so they were out there trying to fix their truck, and they were calling in a tow truck, and there was a little bit of activity going on. And she called me over and whispered to me and said, will you tell them to stop doing all that until I finish my talk? And I just thought, I can't do that. They're working. They're going to stop while we're giving a talk. I don't know what I did. I copped out of it somehow. I think we just did that, actually. So we see how, you know, we come in, we're given beginning instruction in Zazen, we begin sitting, meditation, okay, got it. And this is what you do with your body, this is what you do with your mind, your thoughts, letting go. It's instruction, right? You can do this, you can do this, you can do this. And we very quickly begin to recognize that there's a whole world of things that we need to be drawing upon, that are not so tangible, not so linear, that can't really be given instruction in. It's not so much a matter of do this, don't do that. Things like faith. And all of these more subtle, sort of intangible qualities, kind of magical qualities. I mean, what is faith anyway? It's kind of like love. You know when you feel it, but you can't put it on a scale and measure it. You can't take it out of your pocket and hold it in your hand. You can't. We can speak about it, sing about it, act on it, but we can't hold the thing itself. And so there are all of these elements that very quickly get called upon, right? If we're going to do this, it's not just a matter of do this with your mind, do this with thoughts, because that process isn't linear. And there are moments where you don't want to do that, or you're thinking, why should I do that? Or what's the good of doing that? Or you want to do that, but you can't seem to be able to do that. Or you get tired, or you're impatient, or you get discouraged, or you start comparing yourself with other people. Like, all of these other things start happening. And you may want to just do that thing, follow that instruction, or you're falling asleep. You don't want to fall asleep, but you are. And so how do you not fall asleep? What do you need to call upon? And so there are all of these subtle aspects of us, human nature, sort of the wonder of human consciousness. Who knows what kinds of qualities other creatures have? And so Asanga says we need to have faith in order to achieve what we have not yet achieved, whatever that might be, in the Dharma. To just actually do Zazen, to get to the cushion, to practice mindfulness, to develop that into concentration, to be more steady and stable, to be more kind. We want to achieve those. We want to develop those things. We haven't developed them yet, or they're not very well developed yet, or they're in the process of developing. And so we need something, right? It's not just, well, I have the desire to do that, and that's enough. We have to have faith that we can do that, that there's a reason why we want to do that, based in something. Other people have done that. And he says, faith refers to conviction, having conviction. Right, so it's not just, that's where it starts to become something more, you know, faith is like a feeling, a desire, something sort of mysterious within us, and then it can sort of translate into a conviction. We're sort of moving towards intention. He says, when one desires to make an end of pain and to go into the fullness of joy, then we must make firm the root of faith and fix it, the spirit of this firmly on enlightenment, on our aspiration. So, of course, you know, these words are used in English. They're part of our language. We use them in lots of different ways. And so what Asanga is doing is he's speaking about them in very particular ways. So here, faith means this. We cultivate it because there's something we want to do. There's something we want to work towards, to accomplish. There's something we desire, which is both, we could think of it as, you know, motivation we might think of as what's moving us from behind. I want to relieve myself of my confusion, my pain, my suffering, my anxiety, my sense of purposelessness, and I want to move towards, I don't want to just relieve that, I want to move towards the end of joy, he says. All that this life could be. And so in order to be on that path, I need to have faith in the path, in my capacity, and then I need to fix that. I need to keep focusing that. In a way, I can't let it get away. I need to keep bringing it back. Then he quotes a passage from a text. It says, having faith in the Buddhas and their enlightened qualities, and this is why we also employ the bodhisattvas, the non-historical, Manjushri and Avalokiteshvara, Maitreya, these bodhisattvas that are endowed with the qualities, so that we can sort of focus on those qualities in those beings. free of the historical sort of stuff of their lives. They just are carriers of those qualities that we can turn towards. So we have faith in the Buddhas and their qualities, and then we have faith, he says, we can have faith in the practice of those who have studied with those Buddhas, our ancestors, all of those who have come before us. I mean, think about it, if you were, you know, you were you, just moving along, and stirrings within you started wondering, like, is this all there is? Maybe there's something, I want to go look for something, find something. But you never heard of Buddhism. In fact, Buddhism didn't exist. There were no teachers, no teachings that you'd ever see, no centers, nothing. And then you stumbled upon, you know, a Buddhist text, a sutra. And it talked about the Buddha and his enlightenment in every way that we have. But no one had ever done what he did until now. Think about that. Everything would be the same, except no one had ever practiced the path. So we couldn't turn towards those students of the Buddha and reflect on the fact that I may be struggling. I may think that, you know, who am I kidding? I can't do this, or whatever we think. And then we reflect on the fact that people have been doing this for hundreds and hundreds of years. People just like you, just like me, in halls just like this, with different kinds of sounds going on. Or maybe not. And then having faith in the Supreme Bodhi, enlightenment, the thought of these great beings is born within us. And then he says, the text says, faith is the guide. It's the mother, the creator, the protector, and the increaser of all of our virtues, all of our enlightened qualities. Kind of wonderful. It's our guide, it's our mother nurturing us. It's the creator from whence it comes, the protector. Faith protects us, in a sense, from doubt, from insecurity, and it increases. And so we have faith in something we don't know yet to be true. We practice, and then we experience something, and it verifies, it validates that faith. That faith was well placed, and so that faith now increases. It says, faith is the calm of the undefiled thought. The defiled thought, think of as doubt, our fears, our insecurities, all the things that make us wobbly. Faith is calming of that. Faith brings joy even in renunciation, even when we need to renounce something, to let go of a desire, to not go in a habitual pattern, right, in which we would get some sort of pleasure, satisfy something for a moment. Faith, we have faith in something more than that, something larger, something deeper, something more trustworthy, which grounds us, gives us joy, gives us faith. It says it's not attached to the joys that do attach. In other words, it's not, doesn't arise from and doesn't breed the kinds of attachments that our ordinary pursuits do. It goes beyond the path of Mara and reveals the path of deliverance. He says, those who always have faith and respect for the Buddha never abandon moral conduct or the precepts. And in that way, those who don't abandon their moral conduct, the precepts, give themselves without jealousy to praise of those who possess virtues. It's like gladness, sympathetic joy. That within faith, and when we're practicing well within that, then we can be generous, we can be magnanimous, not envious or jealous of others when we see them possessing virtues. I remember many years ago sitting in the Zendo, more than once, but on one particular occasion, and just suddenly sort of thinking about everybody else and, you know, how this person is smarter and this person's more articulate and this person's more of this and this person's more of this. They all got bigger and I got smaller. They got big and fat with all of their virtues, and I got, you know, impoverished. And then I remember thinking, you know, do I really feel bad that this person is more clear, more compassionate, more articulate, better at this? I mean, when I looked at it more calmly, more objectively, I realized, yeah, I was feeling that just a minute ago, but I don't want to feed that, right? And I thought, is that why I came here? Did I come here to win this race? The answer was no, I did not. So to be able to be without jealousy of others. And this is different, you know, of course, this is very different from a blind faith. You know, a blind faith would be like, well, the Buddha was enlightened. Isn't that marvelous? That's good enough for me. Right? The fact that the Buddha was enlightened, that's all I need. And I'm going to believe in that. I'm going to act on that. I'm going to fight anybody else who doesn't believe in that. But I'm not going to do anything about it. I'm not going to verify it. I'm not going to follow in his example. I'm just going to have faith that everything the Buddha said is true because he said so. The faith that I think Asanga is talking about comes from mindfulness, from discernment, inquiry, from application, and is meant to be verified. That's the key. I mean, why would Buddhism be such an examining tradition, such an inquiring path, which is disruptive, right? Is raising questions. It raises doubts. It challenges, it tests. Is this true? What's the basis for this? Is this valid? Should I trust this? That's what it's encouraging. It's encouraging that from within faith. It's not encouraging, you know, to stand outside the house and just throw stones at it. Be in the house. Have faith in that, and then question, inquire. In the early teachings, faith is said to be act as the basis for our aspiration and is manifestly, in its nature, trusting, admiring, and emulating with regard to what actually exists. So it's trusting of what is true. It admires what is true. And it wants to emulate it, right? It wants to discover that, to live that for ourselves, which means to shift away from trying to make our lives within dreams and fantasies and make-believe worlds. And a commentator on this said that faith is more of an emotional than a mental aspect. And he talked about the faith that one has in a teacher, which is not just believing what they say, but it's sort of having faith in them and their teaching in a deeper way. That may not even always be fully understood. He said it's not so much having a religious belief, but a faith grounded in reason. So it's not based in a belief, but it's a faith grounded in reason. That is, it's reasonable to have faith. It has confidence in what is true, what is non-deceptive. It said it's like water becoming clear of mud. And this leads to faith that higher qualities can arise within one's own. And really, isn't that the key? Like, why is this important? Not just so that we practice, and have faith that we can practice. It's not, I have the faith that I can do Zazen, but all of those, what those teachings are pointing to, forget about it. No, it's having the faith that I can practice so that I can discover those qualities within myself. And that this, on the basis of this faith, and what's interesting is, I mean, I'm sure it's different for each person, but to arrive here, or to arrive and stay, I would say, for any period of time requires some faith. I mean, we could arrive and we're just exploring, you know, checking it out. Not sure at all. But to actually enter in, to stay, to continue, requires some faith. But in the beginning, it's usually pretty, you know, incipient. It's pretty slight. Because we haven't really engaged it yet. We don't really know what we have faith in or what to have faith in. We might have faith in whatever is stirring within us. We might have faith in whatever contact we've had with Buddhism, which might be not too much, but it's enough. That's the key thing. It's enough. And then on the basis of that, that leads to aspiration, a Sangha said. In the early teachings, aspiration is the wish to be endowed with a particular attribute or to discover something. It's an aspiration towards something. It's not just floating around in empty space. It's an aspiration towards something. And its function is to act as a basis for generating diligence. And so just think about the sort of the ways these work together. So beginning with faith, which is, as a commentator said, more of an emotional, it's sort of a non-tangible. It's not just an idea, it's something you feel. And you may feel it in a small way, you may experience it in a big way. And because it's not a thing, it will fluctuate. Sometimes it's very present, very powerful, very motivating, very guiding, and otherwise, at other times, it may feel like you don't feel it much at all. And those are often periods of challenge when that faith becomes distant or dim. Because in that space, doubts, insecurities, skepticism, cynicism. I remember we had a student years ago, a young student, who had been here for a year and was working on Mu, and as is usual, was, you know, a little tied up in knots and was getting more and more frustrated. And then their residency ended and they sent me a note later, a letter, this was before email, and said that they realized that Mu is just a bunch of shit, right? It's just something that Zen people made up to get people to sit and keep them on the cushion. It's not really anything. There's not really a koan. Nobody really ever sees it. There's no realization that comes from it. It just sort of keeps you out of the streets and on, you know, on the cushion. That's what happens when faith drops away. Something will fill its space. And so its function is to, aspiration is to act, which is seeking something. Then acts as a basis for generating diligence. Because again, faith is something we feel. Aspiration has all this potential, but it's not, has no arms and legs yet. It's just an aspiration. That's why bodhicitta is spoken of in terms of adopting, as Shantideva calls it, adopting bodhicitta, raising bodhicitta, having that faith, having that desire, having that aspiration, but then there's attending to bodhicitta, being motivated by that to engage. And he says, the desire for this object has been thought about, has been reflected on. It's important, right? It's not just an impulsive. You know, something I've noticed that happens occasionally is that someone who, for instance, was a student for, I'm thinking of several specific examples, people who were students, sincere students, sometimes for quite a while, and then for various reasons left, right? Sometimes they had a family or their work changed careers or they just moved away from practice. And then seemingly out of the blue, I'll get a phone call or an email, and they'll say, I want to come back in. I want to start again. I want to be a student. I want to train. I say, okay, great. Why don't you just start practicing, start training, right? We haven't seen you in a while. start do that very thing that you feel very strongly about doing. Because in their letters or their calls, it's always there's a lot of energy, there's a lot of urgency. And I say, okay, great. You know, I'm encouraging. It's like, okay, let's do that. It'll be great to see you again. And then nothing. Nothing. And I've wondered about that, you know, because it feels very sincere, like something's going on. Maybe something happened in their life, or they touched something again, or something in them was reawakened. And they reach out, maybe a little impulsively. And then what they're met with is, think about this, in the sense of, okay, that means you want to do something, right? It's not just, I feel this very strong urge, can I have it? Can I get that now? But it's like, I'm going to have to do something. And I've actually done that before, I already know about it. But maybe I haven't really reflected on the ramifications of what I'm actually thinking about or asking about. And so then it just sort of drops away. For now, who knows what happens next? So to reflect, to have some sense of what's going on. It says, a mental factor aspiration is upon observing something that we desire that seeks to attain the thing by its own power. In other words, we understand that which we seek is going to come from within us. Somebody can't get that for us, can't give that to us. And it talks about aspiration and wanting to actually encounter that thing that we seek. And then in encountering it, wanting to not be separated from it. And then in encountering it and not being separated from it, now the aspiration is to, the language says to obtain it, but is to realize it, to awaken to it, to bring it to life. And that object could be the relief of my pain and confusion. It could be the Dharma. It could be the true self. It could be compassion. And then on the basis of this aspiration, actually, before that, in the other fascicle by Dogen on bodhicitta that we're not studying, that I mentioned a couple of times, but please do, but we're just not making it a formal part of the study of the Ango. Dogen says, now the cause for the aspiration of enlightenment does not lie anywhere else. It's not somewhere else. The aspiration for enlightenment is aroused by the aspiration for enlightenment itself. It's self-generating, it's self-fulfilling, it's self-increasing, it's self-verifying, validating. Maybe most virtues, qualities are like that. Maybe most states are like that, right? That when they arise, if we, you know, give energy to them, then they increase. And so when we arouse the aspiration, arouse bodhicitta, and give it energy based in our faith, then it increases. Dogen says, to arouse the aspiration for enlightenment, pick up a blade of grass and manifest it as a Buddha. To arouse the aspiration for enlightenment is to make an offering of sand or rice water to the Buddha. It is to make an offering of food to sentient beings, like an oryoki. It is to make an offering of a bouquet of flowers to the Buddha, like on the altar. It is to practice a small virtuous act with the encouragement of someone else. Maybe you've done that already this week. Or to bow to the Buddha following a demon's deceptive advice. Maybe you've done that already this week. This is also arousing the aspiration for enlightenment. Further, you abandon the household. That is the household of our samsara. By realizing that your house is not a true house, You enter the mountain and practice Dharma. You create a Buddha image and build a stupa. You chant a sutra and recite the Buddha's name. You look for a teacher and inquire about the way. You sit in meditation. You bow to the three treasures. You recite homage to the Buddha. All of this, Dogen says, is to arouse the aspiration for enlightenment. It's not just one thing. It's all of these things. And it's happening even in those moments of bowing, of offering this gesture. There is something happening within us that is the arousing of bodhicitta. And then on the basis of this aspiration, from the depth of one's heart, there is the striving through diligence. As the teachings often do, the aspiration, as so with the faith, is not necessarily from the depth of our heart. It may just be sitting on the surface of the skin or just be below the skin or a little bit deeper. But the teachings are very often sort of presenting us with the whole mountain. Right? This is the mountain we're going to climb. While we're just, you know, trying to get to the foot of it. We're just walking on the first mile. But the teachings keep saying, yes, there you are. Excellent. Remember, there's the whole mountain. And so from the depth of one's heart, there's the striving through diligence. So again, faith, aspiration, really important, but what are we doing with the energy of that? Diligence. This is vidya, the paramita, of joyful effort. And so it said, it is a completely joyous mental state. And I remember when I first, well, for not just first, for a while, when I would encounter the teaching of vigor, and then it was described as a joyful effort. It was like, whoa, that is really not my experience right now. Effort I get, the joyfulness. But it was so important for me, more than I even knew. Because that just sounded like a voice coming from another land. It sounded like another language that I didn't understand. How could those two go together? But it was so important that I encountered that because it raised that question. That inquiry, that kind of doubt. How could this be joyful? How is it not being joyful? How am I not practicing this in a way that it could be a completely joyful mental state? When I was first assigned to be the cook, the tenzo, they used to be the same. And I spent all of these years in restaurant work for many years. And at the last job I had, I actually got fired. I think for good reasons, but nothing illegal. And I thought, I am not going to look for another restaurant job. I'm done with that. And so when I came here and I went on to staff within the first few months, I was having lunch and Myotai Sensei came and sat down next to me. She wasn't Myotai Sensei yet. She said, we'd like for you to be the new cook. And I said, oh, thank you very much. I appreciate that. But you know, I don't think so. You know, I've spent a lot of years in kitchen. I don't want to be the cook. And she said, okay, you'll start tomorrow. And I did. And I remember complaining to one of the seniors about it. Because I just thought, okay, I'm back in the kitchen. I'm never going to sit. Because back then, it was different. We weren't cooking for as many people as Yukon, if he were here, would say. He was always railing about that whenever I would talk about those early days. But the cook did everything. Shopped, menu, all three meals of every day. There was not a lot of support other than, you know, thanks for the meal. Sometimes. And so I was complaining to this senior student, you know, it's going to wreck my practice, and like, oh my God, da, da, da. Complaining, whining. And he said, look, he said, there are a lot of ways to get up the mountain. He says, you can walk and just bitch and moan at every step, or you can just walk. And he walked away. And I thought, and that really changed it for me. Because I realized, okay, I see what you're seeing, the way I'm walking right now, and what you're saying is, I don't have to do that. There's another way. A completely joyous mental state. In the context of, and this is where diligence is referred to in different ways, but has the qualities of resilience, of being undaunted, not discouraged easily, of not reversing. In other words, just to be steady, be steady, be steady, like a flowing stream, to not fall into complacency. Again, these wonderful, wonderful qualities. To not be discouraged, which means we get discouraged. To be steadfast, because we do retreat at times. To not fall into complacency, because we get complacent. It says, diligence is necessarily delighting in virtue, as comes from following the bodhisattva path. Therefore, making effort in worldly activities is not diligence as it's understood here. In other words, we can be diligent in lots of things, in lots of different ways. I mean, people work crazy, in crazy ways, to do all kinds of things in their life, right? I mean, crazy just, I mean, you know, apply supreme or extreme amounts of effort for things that they want to accomplish. So yes, acknowledge that. But that what is being spoken about here is specifically not in the pursuit of fame or wealth or power or those kinds of things that can motivate us and can motivate us to do good things, but bring along with them other things. And that here, this is the diligence applied to the path of non-attachment, of selflessness, of cultivating compassion, of fulfilling our vows. And that the diligence then is applied towards what? So we're cultivating faith, and that brings forth a courage, really? A kind of courage to have an aspiration? It's bold. You kind of have to have some gumption to do this, right? Because you're not just looking at a group of people over there doing something that takes a lot of gumption. You're one of those people. That is a courageous act, to do something that is difficult and that is told to you from the very beginning. You know, this isn't going to be a cakewalk. And you're not going to do it during this introductory retreat, or this session. It's going to take time. And we hear that, we may hear it, we may not, but nevertheless we enter. And so the courage of that then brings forth our diligence, which we apply towards the fourth aspect that Asanga teaches, which is the method, practice. So that all of that is bringing us, is being brought into our practice itself, which is described as attaining the state of heedfulness. Remember in the Buddha's last moments, his last words, one of the essential things, that sort of very sort of seminal things that he said, or if that's the right use of that word there, but the essential things that he said is to be heedful, not heedless, to be conscientious. It's not just being active, right? There's a quality to it. There's conscious, it's intentional, it's thoughtful. You know what you're doing. You know why you're doing it. And so there's mindfulness, Asanga says, characterized by the absence of forgetfulness. Mindfulness being focusing on the object of your meditation and not forgetting it. And then there is the awareness as you're doing that to recognize when heedlessness arises. When something arises that would both make you forget the object of your meditation, but would also begin to undermine your diligence, your aspiration, your faith, your patience. And that we're cultivating in the diligence being applied to the practice to being heedful in both of these ways. Being mindful, so we stay focused, we keep your eye on the ball. In the direct sense, like your meditation practice, when you're doing kin-in, in each moment of the day, and in the largest sense of being on the path and having a sense of where you are with that. You may be very clear about that. You may not be clear about that. Completely legitimate. Wherever you are, to be mindful of that and to be heedful with wherever you are, with whatever you're doing. Because that's how we allow ourselves to experience that place where we are in its greatest potential, right? As opposed to, you know, from over here, rather from inside. So to appreciate how these different elements, and this is just one list, right? In a tradition of many, many lists, right? Buddhism is a list-making kind of thing, right? But to appreciate how these are all woven together like a tapestry, how they work together, they rely on each other, they sort of feed into each other, they're self-affirming, self-supporting, right? One complete, unified, intelligent, self-affirming body-mind. Dogen says, there are those who arouse the aspiration for enlightenment in a dream and so attain the way. There are those who arouse the aspiration for enlightenment while intoxicated, and others by seeing scattering flowers or falling leaves among peach blossoms or green bamboo, and attain the way in a deva realm or in the ocean. They all attain the way. And so it seems clear, he's just saying that we can arouse aspiration in all manner of ways, in all different states, in all different times in our life, in all different situations. And what is important is just the arousing. And for that arousing, it doesn't happen in a vacuum. We don't practice in a vacuum. These different elements that we rely upon. And of course, these are not qualities just for doing sesshin or practicing the Dharma. It's for living, to live within faith, to live with aspiration, right? To be diligent, for those to arise out of a thoughtfulness, a self-reflection, means that we're in contact, we're engaged. We're not just kind of wandering through. And that's just good. If it's based in what is good, whether a person is practicing Buddhism or not. But in practicing the Dharma, it's essential. And we see that when we encounter moments and we realize you're just trying to follow the instruction. And you need more. You need something within you, right, to call upon, you know, a faith, a determination, a patience. And that's usually when we discover it. One complete, unified, intelligent, self-affirming body and mind. A fading light, cooling winds, drying leaves, a gathering of nuts, A flock flying south, a stacking of firewood. This is September's song of one life lived everywhere by everyone.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.